No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008, or you can send your questions to us through our shadow box on the BBS radio website. First, let me introduce my illustrious co-host. How are you, Maria?
We are having triple-digit heat for forever in Southern California. It's been terrible. But other than that, I know those are white-collar problems, and we're doing well, healthy, and safe. Thank you. How about you, Michael?
Good. I'm doing fine, and we don't have any forest fires in Washington, D.C., so we're all got our fingers crossed, and we're praying for you Californians.
Thank you.
And we're very lucky tonight to have with us, again, Admiral Joe Sestak, who was a presidential candidate in 2020. And for our listeners who may not know, be familiar with Admiral Sestak, let me just give you a few of the highlights from his career. He's just been an amazing person that's served our country for decades. And he is a retired three-star admiral with more than 31 years of service in the Navy. He was a two-term representative from Pennsylvania's 7th District, the highest-ranking military officer ever elected to Congress. He was a Democratic presidential candidate. He was the salutatorian of his Navy Academy class and commander of the GW Carrier Group. I'm not even sure what to call this man because he's had so many illustrious titles: congressman, admiral, doctor. So welcome back to the show, Admiral Sestak. We're so
Senator, thanks.
And two advanced degrees from Harvard.
2 degrees from Harvard, yeah.
Well, look, to both of you, I'm really, really honored to be back with you. And Maria, I think it was you who said lots changed since the last time we spoke. Geez, must have been about 8 months ago. Mm-hmm. So, but I think we're on the cusp of change, and let's just hope, Lord willing, we are.
So when we spoke with you, Admiral, you were ensconced in a motel doing your campaigning, and they were doing remodeling or something, so you had to deal with the banging and all of that stuff going on. You want to give our listeners an update on that, what that was like?
Well,
if they
didn't
hear our interview,
I got in very late, not until May timeframe to the presidential race, and so I decided to camp out in Iowa without leaving there, and the best rate I could get was the Motel 6. And out there, I got a reduced rate there because they were doing a lot of construction. And what a great memory. But it boded out pretty well. It was owned and managed by a wonderful immigrant from India. And he had me gather with his entire quite large Indian community there. And then the Latinos, they actually passed out my brochures and helped me in parades and all. So it had great dividends to be, so to speak, on the deck plates with the sailors there. But I'll tell you, when I got to New Hampshire after about, I would say, 40, 50 days of that, and I did the walk across New Hampshire, And it was a wonderful experience and a bit more liberating to be out there literally in the snow and the storm. It was just a great time, just a tinge of snow, hardly nothing that stuck. So thank you for asking. It was really great going to the people.
Nice.
Well, you know what, Admiral, since you brought up Iowa, let me ask you, we have a new vice presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, and Senator Harris actually didn't make it as far in the primary process as Marianne Williamson, another guest on her show. In fact, she stopped in December, just about the same, almost exactly the same time you did. And there's been a lot of criticism over the years of the primary process, especially the caucuses. What do you think about that? Do you think we should get rid of the caucuses? It's a tradition that I love. I was in Iowa. I love being out there. But is that really the best thing for our party to have these caucuses?
You know, it's a great question. And politically, I should probably just say, oh, no, we've got to keep going. But no, I don't think so, particularly where it starts. I think the caucuses, as they are at the very beginning, have become like any type of bureaucracy or organization. It's kind of lost what it was all about to some degree. Now, I can give you a few examples, but maybe one or two would help. If you want to, for example, speak at the large dinner there, it's like the Jefferson Jackson dinner, well, you have to purchase the voter registration file from the party, which I think was about $120,000 or something.
Wow.
But, you know,
it's like $50.
I sent my guys up to the capital of the Des Moines, to the capital, and got it for like about a couple hundred dollars and put it on a spreadsheet and turned it into a database, and it did mighty fine. So I didn't speak there because I got in late and was trying to raise money. Also, by the way, New Hampshire does the same thing. I think it's $80,000 there, and I did the same thing. And the Chamber of Commerce, wonderful outfit there. I spoke at it. But, you know, this is a money-making type of thing for it. And to some degree, I think the proof of this is we didn't do very well in executing that caucus. And I think that's much like BlackBerry had done very well when it came out, and that got overtaken by the iPhone. And I think change is good. And I think we should distribute. I think primaries are better than caucuses. That's my opinion. I think a change, it doesn't have to be immediate, but an evolution towards that fairly rapidly, I think would bode democracy better.
I agree, and as much as I love the caucuses, and the results of the Iowa caucus didn't come out right away, and you know, and if you look at the leaders from Iowa and New Hampshire, right, Joe Biden was in the dumps at that point, and he ended up being our nominee. So, yeah, I question the usefulness of them.
I could say one other thing that one of the people on the ground mentioned. And again, I don't mean to be critical, but you know, I got out there, and boy, I mean, I ran in every single parade you could go. You know, I remember calling somebody and says, "How many people do you expect at a parade?" And the woman answered me, "Well, probably a lot more than usual because we haven't had a parade for 4 weeks." You know, if a farmer grows more strawberries than their neighbors, they throw a parade in Iowa, and I'm literally they love them. It's door to door. You shake everybody's hands. My volunteers went ahead of me, passed out brochures. I got some homeless when I first arrived there because I didn't have from a homeless shelter for veterans to help me out. Gave them something worth to do and paid them. And that was wonderful. But, you know, the point was someone took me aside and said, look, you're doing this exactly the way it used to be done. You know, maybe 8 years ago, 12 years ago or so. So now people come in, and they rent buses, and they ship people from Des Moines up to Davenport or somewhere else. And as one person said, and another reporter said it to me, said, they're the same people going from groups to have a large crowd there. And so to some degree, again, I think that it's the picture, the moment that you have to capture. How many people are there and all. So I think, by the way, none of this would have changed my outcome. It's just that I think, what you see in the photograph isn't necessarily indicative of the groundswell that's down there, really out there by having worked it hard.
Well, and so, let me just add to that. Okay. I'm sorry, Maria, that many times when I worked for the Democratic National Committee and I would go to a black tie event, I would be dragged and sat in a seat in front of a camera because, five people at the Teamsters table didn't show up and they didn't want an empty table. So they grab a bunch of staff people and they say, go sit over there. And then and then the cameras would move and they go sit over there. So what you say really strikes a true with me. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Maria.
It's okay, because I was going to say, our listeners, while we might know what the Iowa caucus is in general, we don't know specifically. And I know, Senator, you've been to them personally, many of them. We've spoken when you've shown up there. And as the kickoff for the electoral events for our country, I'm curious, one, share what it is, how it looks like, because it's very different from anything else. And why does it still matter? Why do we care what Iowa does?
Well, I mean, it's just, and Admiral Sestak would know better than I, because he's actually been involved as a candidate. But it's really just a showcase, as he just
right.
said.
That's what it sounds like.
And it may set you on the track to give you momentum, because it gives the press something to write about. The beauty of it, from where I come from, is that a bunch of people get together and they talk about who their candidate should be. And if, for example, I want Admiral Sestak and you want Joe Biden, and nobody gets a majority, then I get to go over to the Joe Biden people and try to get them to come over to my side. And I mean, it really is a beautiful act of democracy that these neighbors get together and they talk about all this. And in the end, if there's a tie, they flip a coin, which is, blows.
I mean, it sounds so corny to me. And for our listeners to know, you're speaking physically, you're together in a room,
yes.
and you're physically going from one side to another and having, I'm assuming, respectful, decent, civilized conversations. It's not yelling and name-calling and et cetera.
It's like a pep rally at a high school. You've got the Biden people going, go, Joe, go, Joe, and the Bernie people going, go, Bernie, go, Bernie. But, yeah, there's none of the rancor that you see traditionally in very often in Kim. So it's a beautiful thing to witness, but I agree with the Admiral that it's probably outlived its usefulness.
And yet it persists.
Yes, yeah. And I think it might be better, if you are going to continue it, to have it, and others have said this, perhaps with a demographic that is more representative of the fabric, the threads, the various threads of color that run through our nation today than it did when they started the caucus out there in Iowa. And second, Senator, you're absolutely right. It is quite a thrilling thing to watch. It's almost like back in the 1770s where town hall quick meetings were held and everybody's bickering over what to do and all this kind of stuff. It's true democracy on the deck plate. But also what's happened here is people will sometimes help somebody who's like a third-party candidate, to come in number two so that and throw their weight towards that so that their person who would have been number two, if they hadn't purposely thrown their even though they weren't for that person, that would help their number person would have been number two drop to three overall in the ranking. So you're basically starting to game it also at the same time.
Yes.
Well, that's not undemocratic, but I don't think it's as pure anymore as that one vote, one person.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that is part of the problem. And you're right that Iowa and New Hampshire are not indicative of America. And
can I say one last thing, though, before? Because I will tell you, I would like to say this. What they say about Iowa is so true. Iowa nice. I know they say it about Minnesota, but Iowa nice. I mean, I run through a parade, and I'm shaking every hand. And, you know, I would say one out of every five persons, because my brochures, who I shake their hand off, and I shake every hand. I start at the head of the parade, and I work my, I usually end 20 yards behind the parade. So, and, but my brochure had a picture of me briefing President Clinton in the White House when I was on his staff in uniform. And inevitably, one out of five, Republican, Democrat, didn't matter, would say either stand up or say it sitting down, thank you for your service. I mean, there was something out there that Iowa Nice is true. And I just needed to throw that out there because that's, I think, Senator, makes it to your point of why these caucuses aren't quite as bitter as you might expect. You know, they're conducted, they're tough, there's tensions at times, but they really have something out there that they've captured that's missing in society too much today.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I remember being in Des Moines and having police officers walk up to me and say things like, you look lost, sir. Are you having a good time in Des Moines? Where can we, you know, they were acting like tour guides. And I was just taken aback by it. I was like, wow, you know, and there is this feeling out there when you go to the caucuses that this is their big event. And they're welcoming you, you know, they're welcoming you to their home. Just like, you know, I guess New Orleans has the Mardi Gras and you, Maria, have the Rose Bowl parade.
Right.
But yeah, there's this feeling that welcome to Iowa. Everybody wants to give you a hug. It's very sweet and you're very, very right, Admiral. They may be the nicest people I've ever met.
Yep.
Let me ask you something. You were elected and then reelected in a heavy Republican district in Pennsylvania. In fact, in your reelection, you won by 20% when you were a member of Congress. What do we need to do as Democrats to convince the Republicans that we're ready to lead and that we can, you know, and how do we appeal to Republicans the way you obviously did?
Well, perhaps it was when I was a congressman that really made a difference, because I was given an unfortunate opportunity. I became congressman just as the Great Recession began. And we decided to run my office. My classmate from the Naval Academy ran my office. We went to the academy together from rival high schools. We were best friends even today. And he was in my carrier battle group for the war in the George Washington, commanding a cruiser as I had the battle group. And he said, Joe, we're going to keep this open. We're going to treat these our people here just like they're our sailors when we're in danger. Office is going to be open from 8 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock every night, 7 days a week. We'll get 60 interns, and we're going to rotate them underneath our staff. And that's what we did. We handled four times the number of constituents' cases the average congressional office. We saved over 1,000 homes from foreclosure. ABC did two stories about us.
Wow.
And we just did it not by working magic, but by being open and being competent about showing proven performance of saying your house is under foreclosure, here's the programs we can go to. By the way, Congressman Sessex needs you to sign this, giving him authority to call over to, and I did, my staff did, over to Wells Fargo and say, I hear that you're telling, can I see the documentation why you have taken a foreclosure? And of course, we found out a decade later that they were wrongly doing that in times. We had people who would come from all over. And I bring that up because I think that's where we are today. That today, I think the biggest thing the Democrats need to understand is right now it is about something American people do not accept in a war. And as Mr. Trump said, we are in a war with this pandemic. And they don't like incompetent generals, particularly when lives, which they have been lost. This race is all about competence. And I have no doubt that if this administration steps in and begins to make government work for the people, not just have the greatest idea and let's go make the biggest change. Yeah, we can do some of that, but make it be competent. I got reelected, as you said, by 20 points. I had raised $3 million, just like I did my first race, to spend. I didn't spend a penny on one television or paper or any kind of radio ad, not one penny. Mm. We had town halls open every night. Man, the Tea Party was starting to come about 2 years later. I just stayed there 3.5 hours, every one of the 10 of them. And I think that gets to your point about the caucuses and the value attendant to them. And why I walked across New Jersey, we tended to go to the people so that they knew not about me, but they knew that I knew them. Mm. And as I end this, there's that wonderful story you're both familiar with, where FDR, after Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, and his casket was being taken on a train up to Hyde Park to be buried. And an African-American was standing in, they say, South Carolina, as the train went by, with tears in his eyes. And a reporter walked over to him and I said, "Did you know the president?" And he replied, "No, but he knew me." Yeah. And that is the way a good captain of a ship gets the undying, continued loyalty of the troops. And that's the way the president needs to be.
Absolutely. I can't agree with you more. I think that this has been a problem for us for many years nationally, that we tend to talk back down to people instead of trying to feel their pain. And let me follow up with this question, in this situation where there's a lot of manipulation going on right now. And one of those things, of course, is the post office cutting funding and some of the problems you see taking postal machines offline, which I guess is done in an effort to, affect the outcome of the election. And David Gergen, who we all know, who worked for Republicans and Democrats, said yesterday that they should form a bipartisan panel to look into the post office situation to decide what should be done. And maybe somebody from the military, somebody that people would trust, should, that's the person they should appoint to head the commission. Now, with advice from my dad, Lieutenant Donald Brown, who said, "Never volunteer for anything." Would you volunteer to do that? Because nobody I would trust more than you.
I didn't know where this was going, but let me just say this. I honestly do believe, again, Senator, you hit the right word, trust.
Yeah.
It is the biggest deficit we have in America today. And if it is a military person, whoever it is, even if it were to be Joe Sesta, whoever it is, that is the most important element, because people no longer trust. They just don't. And so therefore, when you don't trust, you are open to fear. And that's the other danger about this pandemic, and how our CDC, even from the beginning, acted before it was muzzled and other things. It wasn't ready. It wasn't prepared. "Oh, you don't need face masks," the scientists said. And then all of a sudden they changed it. To some degree, I am concerned that science is going to take a hit. I know I double check even more than I used to. What are different scientists saying? Because if they couldn't even get the mask right, and they weren't prepared to lay out all the PPE like they should have been. And by the way, the general who was executing this in the Oval Office was inept and dangerous in not being capable of knowing and judging the right way to approach it. I got that. But I fear that this issue of trust is only distrust is only growing. And if you're going to be trusted, you have to be able to step up and say, "I made a mistake here." And that's very important, because if you aren't able to do what John F. Kennedy did at the Bay of Pigs, where he said, "Defeat is an orphan. Victory has 1,000 followers. This was my fault." But he also said, "I will never listen to the experts again." But he was trusted, I believe, because he admitted he had made a mistake. And we never have any leaders that seem to do that.
Well, it's certainly not going to come from this individual in the White House. I mean, that's the last thing he's going to do is apologize for anything or admit that he's flawed in any way, shape, or form. So, I mean, that's a fool's game. But what I'm wondering is, Pelosi apparently is considering recalling Congress back over the post office debacle. And, I mean, one could argue that he is trying to hijack the system, even though he considers absentee ballots different than mail-in ballots. And I'm not quite sure what your take is on that. What's the difference?
There is no
voting
difference.
By mail. Right.
You said it very well. It is an ineptness, whether it's conscious as it is now, or whether it's not. I think it's so inexcusable. Of what he's trying to do. We should be making voting easier to do.
Yes.
That the love of your country is how you is your vote. And you do not make the love of your child more difficult by saying, "Nope, I'm sorry. Don't write me any letters. You can only come and see me." It is inept what he is doing, and I think it's extraordinarily harmful, and it's only adding to what I'm talking about this lack of trust.
Well, on another note, though, do you mind me asking,
yep.
Admiral, I'm sorry, Senator, how is Alex doing?
She
you don't have to answer. If
yeah, and we just haven't told. I mean, I don't mean to do this in public, but anyway.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry.
I don't mean to embarrass you. We just, you know, it happened. Cancer came back a third time. Anyway.
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry.
But thank you for asking. That just shows how kind of a person you are. And I appreciate that you did. Trust me. There was nothing more important. And let me just leave it with a wonderful line. Favorite play was Wicked. At Christmas, we would take her wherever she wanted to that Wicked was playing. In America.
Really?
Idaho, yep. Broadway, Baltimore. And her very last time we saw her was just before we went out to Seattle, just as the pandemic was starting, because we had, as my campaign was ending, we were went on trial one over at Children's here in D.C., and darn thing didn't work, so we leaped over to go to Seattle. I landed there one March, just as the pandemic was starting. But before we went, a fine doctor got our tickets changed from mid-March to last day or so in February so she could see it in Baltimore. And, man, we're sitting there, and she's singing along with it.
Huh.
And that wonderful line came up, which I'll always live with. Because I knew her, I was changed for good. And that's – I was very fortunate. Anyway, I didn't mean to go on.
I'm so sorry.
No.
Michael and I are both parents, so we can't imagine your pain. I'm so sorry.
Anyway, but you were very kind to ask. Thank you.
And let me just add, Admiral, that I was an orphan raised by an older sister who I lost when I was in my early 30s and she was in her 40s. And the last thing we did was we went to New York and we saw Les Miserables, which was her favorite play. So, and I would say the same thing to you. I would say the same thing that you just said, even though it's been more than 30 years for me. And that is my life was better for having known her. And I cherish every moment that we spent together. So again, our great condolences. Let me also ask you what you think of what's going on right now in America. Yesterday, we had 17 people shot in Cincinnati. Earlier last week, we had 21 people shot at a birthday party here in Washington, D.C. We see the military entering places like Portland. Should we be calling in the military to support the police? I mean, in this tumultuous time, where people are talking about defunding the police department. What should the military play a role in any of this domestically, or is that dangerous for us?
Absolutely not. It should not even be close to this.
Yeah.
This is an extraordinarily worrisome moment. If somebody felt the National Guard was to be called up, it should be taking over. The police should be doing what they know best how to do. We are not trained in the military of how to best deal where the majority of police officers do. We know from Black Lives Matter and George Floyd that there are truly, truly extraordinarily horrific incidents. That said, we should not be putting a young 18-year-old man or woman not trained into that kind of a situation, or the violence could only be worse. They could take over doing the traffic lights for them, police, or take over doing the desk jobs for them,
traffic,
so they can be on the front line. But I think this is something more indicative of a deeper ill in this nation. And that ill is the ability that of, you know, good order and discipline. And by that, I don't mean the military type. I mean the type that everybody breaks for a red light. Who doesn't stop for it? And yes, you're always going to have crime. But crime is down overall here in America on a downward trend. And all of a sudden you have this horrific bump ups by certain types. No, this is one where those domestically within the city who know the people and all well need to deal with it. And we could take some of the burden off that is not police work, so to speak, of the front line. But that would be the most I would ever do. The police are capable of doing this more than that. Leaders, whether they come from the churches or whether they come from political life, and this is where too many political people have been seen as out for having crossed that fine line between service and ambition of taking a job and running for it. But if they can regain that trust again and be out there with them, I think you can handle this situation.
Well, you know, I remember because I was in high school at the time. I was, and you weren't too far beyond that. At Kent State, they said that was a big problem, was that they put a bunch of kids basically out there who had never been in combat, who had never, you know, been in a situation like that. They were National Guardsmen, and we all know what happened there.
The picture of that woman on her knees with her arms outstretched is exactly what flashed through my mind when you talked about the military going in to handle these situations.
Yeah. Okay, Maria, your turn.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have been following what's going on in my community about the pastor who is refusing to not hold church services on Sunday without social distancing and without face masks. And they're found him in contempt, and then the county is not choosing to enforce it. And he's the only pastor in the United States that's openly defying what we're supposed to be doing. So he was found in contempt of court, and then the sheriff's office refused to close the church, and that hasn't happened. But there's a hearing scheduled for August 21st to follow up on this. And in the meantime, 1,500 people go to his church, and they're all being exposed.
It reminds me, I don't mean to interrupt, but you've also got the sheriff in Florida. You know,
right. Who's demanding that you take off your mask before you go into his station or precinct or whatever you want to call it.
This situation, and you brought up a wonderful point, Maria. I mean, America's this fine balance of the two greatest characteristics of our nation, rugged individualism, but always in balance with the common good, the common welfare. And you can see that on a ship. There's three things we fear at sea, particularly in the days when ships were wood. One was a fire. Yeah. The other was a mutiny. But the third was sickness, a plague. Mm-hmm. And this is no different. If it ever happened, everything stopped. Everybody got away. Everybody knew that, you know, you just had to stop this thing from spreading for the common good. And somehow we've lost too much of that in too many parts of our nation. But on the other hand, let's go back to Iowa. Some of this may be coming about. I'm not talking about the church right now. I think if the rules are rules and you've held in contempt, that thing should be enforced. But second is, out in Iowa, there was a police chief, I found out, who used to be, I think it was in Newark, New Jersey, or somewhere in New Jersey, in a tough city that had some higher rate crime. And so I called him up. And I said, you know, I want to ask you something. What's it like being a police chief out there and a police chief here in Iowa? I mean, is crime less? Because there's such as Iowa niceness. He says, no, we have the same amount of crime as we per capita as I did back in New Jersey. It's just a different type of crime. Where before I had holdups and murders and all kinds of pretty vicious, I don't have very much of those here. What I do have is domestic violence. I do have misdemeanors and, you know, small petty thefts and stuff and drug dealings and stuff like that. I said, why? He said, because I am the social welfare. Because we don't give these people, so many of them, where of the 67 counties, all but about five have declining populations and a few additional ones are steady. They're all leaving the rural areas. And so, in a sense, people, they have had, out of their 17 rural hospitals, if I have the numbers right, and I could be slightly wrong, they've have about five more of those going to close in the next 5 years. And they've already had a certain number, like 20% close. And so they hear us talking about Medicare for All, the Democrats. But Medicare for All is based upon for-profit hospitals. So Johns Hopkins, the University of Penn. What for-profit hospital is ever going to go into a rural community again where these people live? It costs for a heart attack, if you have one there, to get medevaced out. $36,000, even if you're paying your $12 every month to get a Hilo ride in an emergency. Who's ever going to go there as an employer, et cetera? And yet, Medicare for All isn't going to have a for-profit hospital in that place. And I bring this up only in the sense that when I said something else is going on, this common good, if not just in the pandemic, but for too long, we have seen in the city, inner cities, or in the rural counties, this inequality of the sharing in that common good. And so to some degree, you can't, they say, well, you know, you want me to wear a pen, you don't even take care of me, and you want me to worry about wearing a mask. And I know I'm reaching a little bit here, but I don't think it's too much. Too long we've had this inability to see the other side at both parties to really understand what those rurals are going through, as well as where too many are disenfranchised in our cities.
Well, you know, Admiral, I couldn't agree with you more. I think people are people, and that you're right. In the Democratic Party, I can't talk about the Republican Party because I've always been a Democrat, but I think far too often we don't try to see the other side. We don't try to see other people's pain. We assume that which we feel, everybody feels. And I would only add to that I grew up in North New Jersey, so I'm glad I didn't talk to you earlier. I would have been afraid to go to Iowa if I found out that the crime in Iowa was like it was in Newark. But, you know, that's so true. And for years I've said that rather than sit down at the table and talk about the Second Amendment, what we want to say too often is, hey, you don't need a gun and you're too dumb to realize it, so let us explain it to you. Why you don't need it, and rather than sitting down and listening and trying to have a conversation about it. And I think it stands in our way so many times. But can I ask you, since you were in charge of a carrier group in the Middle East and you know the area, what about the deal between Israel and the UAE? Is this making the region more stable, do you think?
I think it will make the region a bit more stable. Of course, the reason it's being done is the UAE understands that after Israel, the UAE is the biggest enemy, almost, with Saudi Arabia, of Iran. There's the beginning of a bloc out there. And that, I hope, will be a bit more stable, but I'm not sure. And I have to be frank. I think more people should have focused upon the words that were used upon Israel's suspending its annexation of territories within the Western Bank and all. I don't like the word suspend. It should have been end. And to me, I think that, you know, when you have such a community so disenfranchised, and now their Arab allies, so to speak, are leaving them alone. You can agree or disagree what's going on, but that doesn't bode for a more restful, peaceful populace right there. And frankly, I think I was probably the only presidential candidate that said I felt they should have marched, the next president should move the capital back to Tel Aviv, out of Jerusalem. You cannot make a deal between two parties if you've already made a decision and executed it upon what the parameters are supposed to be they're going to negotiate upon. But I do think that, to your overarching point, let's hope it's for more peace, because I think we can easily fix the Iranian problem if we go back to the nuclear accord and begin to engage and with the Arabs and all, make sure that their nefarious activities in Syria and others don't occur. Their big challenge for us is in the Western Pacific with China. And I mean economically. I mean data-driven collection. And, of course, to some extent, potentially militarily. And I think that's, we've lost our focus. It didn't have our focus on that for way, way too long. And I do think that President Trump, I don't think he's gone about it he's fairly ineptly, I think, but he's correct to focus on issues like 5G and even TikTok. I think his tariffs was the wrong approach. The only way to make this work is Ronald Reagan did something like this economically with Japan. But Japan had a GDP about 20-25% of ours at the time. China's probably going to surpass us, they say, in 4 or 5 years. And we needed to bring together the global order and say, hey, no trading here with any of us unless you go by the rules of the road. And that's the missing piece. And that's where the real challenge for us is going to be for the next few decades.
And is China, when you say militarily, I've always had this feeling, and I don't know any, you know, I have no military experience, but don't we have a much stronger military than China?
When the present commander-in-chief of the Pacific, of all the forces, he's an admiral, but he's in charge of the Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, etc., did his testimony in front of the Senate 2 years ago, he said, China now commands the Western Pacific in peacetime. And it's questionable if we can win a war. I bring this up because I backpacked through China the first year they permitted independent travel. I didn't get married, I was 47. Independent travel back in the 80s, early 80s, for Americans. I went into places like Chongqing that had just been opened up to foreigners, and I had crowds of 100 people I'd never seen because they didn't have television there, and who would follow me around. I wish it had been my campaign here in America. But I took pictures of some small warships I saw on the Yangtze River as I went down it on basically a sheepskin boat, a sheep herding boat, because they didn't have tourist boats back then. I slept out there with the sheep. I had a little room with about 10 other people laying on the floor. And I took some of these photographs. But NIS, no interest whatsoever, like I did when I backpacked through communist Europe earlier. They want to know everything, hours of debriefing. And yet today, our submarines are coming home as I was leaving the Navy, and they take their sonar tapes and put them on IBM supercomputers, and they find out, holy mackerel, there was a diesel submarine 1,000 yards from us. We couldn't even detect it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Rand Corporation has run about 18 war games. We've lost every one but one because warfare has changed. It's not about more money. It's not about more ships. We've been saying we want 370 or 345 ships since, I don't know, last two decades. I, as a three-star admiral, submitted to Congress via the CNO a proposal to go down as low as 240 ships, but put the money into, and this was 2005, into cyberspace. The Great Commons of the Seas was owned by physical force of the Navy. The Great Commons of the Air is owned by the Navy and the Air Force is physical, but the commons that everybody owns of cyber, as you can see today with the hacking, is owned by everyone. Whoever can attack through cyberspace and whoever can defend in cyberspace will win the next war, and every war game is lost because our networks are shut down, shattered, to quote one of the players, each time by the Chinese who have made cyberspace in warfare their number one threat. The reason that 5G is so important is because it's not only going to revolutionize economies, but militaries. Because every single thing that goes through the 5G network, America, when it's so Lucent, no longer makes the piece of equipment. Only three companies do. Two in Europe, Ericsson, and Nokia, and Huawei. They're the ones that make the one piece of equipment that's in the wireless equipment that everything, all the data flows through. So China can see everything that goes there, a virtual meeting, et cetera. And if they want to go the other way and close you down, they can. One quarter of all undersea cables are laid now by Huawei. Wow. That means, just like we used to do when we laid them and put little signals, listening devices in them, that everything that will go through an international that's not wireless, they'll listen to and know what's going on. Sure. Warfare is not about another ship. Warfare is about owning the digit world. And that is why we no longer own command the Western Pacific.
So it's information, right? It's intelligence, if you
Absolutely.
Will.
Absolutely. It's intelligence that they're to know what getting. They're doing. And then to be able, when they fire a missile, you don't want to shoot their ship anymore. You want to make sure that the network connected to that missile it shot, that the missile misses its target. See, because now the Navy's talking about unmanned vehicles, if you've read the latest reports this year. We're not going to get with manned. They're too expensive, so we'll go unmanned, which means a lot more data, a lot more databases. Well, that's dangerous unless you can protect them. When China, and I'll stop with this, as you probably heard, because the boards and the servers of Amazon, Apple, this was reported by Bloomberg News about a year and a half ago, as well as CIA drones and Aegis ships, buy chips that go into these servers from China, of which they found, and it's very hard to look at these things without breaking them, which they had to do, chips that were sort of like sleeper agents were in these boards that were going onto these device, these men of war, these which we call our ships men of war. And so that they can be turned on like the old movies of Soviet sleeper agents who slept, you know, here in capitalism. And one day at the age of 35, the war with Soviet Union was going to happen, and they were turned on to do things. Well, that's kind of the world we're running in. This isn't just military. This is, you know, as a wonderful senator from one of the two nuclear submarine building states, Connecticut and Virginia, came to do to do an event for me when I was running for Congress first time, and he came over, very nice man, and he shook my hand and said, Joe, I remember you. You're the admiral that wanted to cut my submarine fleet because I had proposed we only needed 35. We didn't need 54. Who wants a $2 billion submarine when they can't even find, like they could in the old days, the hunt for Red October, the other submarine? And any case, yeah, this is a huge challenge. And the last issue on this is in their Belt and Road Initiative that they have 70 countries, international organizations signed up for. They've given them predatory loans, when they can't pay them off, they have to give them a port. And they're doing this for 42 ports. Excuse me, they have constructing 42 ports. So far, Sri Lanka has given it a lease to own its port for 99 years. Djibouti has given it its first overseas naval base in Africa. And Cambodia, a few months ago, gave its first, to get out of its debt, its first overseas base in Southeast Asia. So they're doing things by engaging economically, but there's always a payback in security for China.
Well, let me ask you, Admiral, since we're running out of time here, about First Global and the Robotics Olympics. First of all, let me be transparent about this. One of the reasons I'm asking you is because I think my alma mater, the University of Maryland, did very well in the last Robotics Olympics. I think I read an article to that effect. But how? Explain what that is.
I will. There's an organization called FIRST that was established a few decades ago here in America, and thousands upon thousands of high schools and others participate, and middle schools, etc. I was called by the gentleman who founded that after I did not win my Senate race, and said, "I want you, Joe, would you mind setting up, since you know the world a bit from the Navy, First Global, and bring together maybe 10 or 15 nations for the first International Robotic Olympics?" So we established to do it at Constitution Hall across from the White House, and we ended up in 9 months having 158 nations sign up and send them over here. We got everyone on President Trump's travel ban list through Iran. I couldn't ship them the robot. Export controls denied it, so that they had to bill. It was a competition. They had to, you know, clean up things in three teams on one side, three teams on the other side, and they have about 2 minutes to make their computers do the best way they can, pick up the balls, throw it in the basket, whatever. And so I also put together 800 youth across America in a Peace Corps online. I called it the Global STEM Corps. Carnegie Mellon, University of Maryland, they all helped out these graduate students who were in computer science, and they'd adopt the Congo. Because the Congo, 60% of these nations had never had a STEM course, because I make sure this wasn't for the 1%ers coming from each of the African countries. No. My wife works in Africa, and she helped me, you know, go to the deck plates and find those that were even more than disenfranchised. And they'd never seen a robot. They'd never, so we put together, and they often had to find a place of where these five people had to sign up, and they, so you know, work with these teams in Kazakhstan and other places to help them put it together. And when they, you know, how about this, try this, do this. And it was a wonderful Peace Corps online, so to speak. And then they all came over, led by an all-girls Muslim team from Afghanistan, because when I was on the ground in Afghanistan near the beginning of the war, about a month or two into it, very short period of time, very short, I remember thinking, man, you know, we're going to do more than to win this war. Well, we can do more if we fix the illiteracy rate of women, which was 98% in Afghanistan at the beginning of the war, than anything our military is going to do to win it. And we still haven't won it, as you know, in Afghanistan. So I had found an all-girls Muslim team of women. They came together and never done robots, and brought them together and brought them on over. And if you might remember, President Trump helped get them in. They were the only one that got denied a visa. There was a human trafficking concern at the time, which wasn't true, and they redid it. And they came together, and I have to tell you, the last night, many of those countries went out to the Washington Monument and just sang songs and did it. It's a wonderful advantage of what America's greatest strength is: convene the world for the greater good. And that's what we did after World War II. And because we did, with the World Health Organization, when it really was good, that's what we did with the UN and with defense treaties, 67 of them, and that's what we did with humanitarian assistance and other things, the IMF, etc. We brought the poverty rate down near poverty, a very low poverty rate, very, very, very extreme poverty, from 60% of the world down to less than 30%. We brought the literacy rate of the world from about 35% all the way up to almost 70% in those years, we made great progress under U.S. leadership, which wasn't always perfect. I get that. Take Iraq. But we really did a lot, and that's why I said I would do it, kind of as a reminder that our American dream is best advanced by bringing the world together in a peaceful way that helps everyone have an opportunity. And then we can better trade with them. There's more peace, and we don't waste money on that, etc. So that, again, is was one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. And I can't tell you, so many people, when I got in the presidential race, I had something like 10 people contribute from overseas who were the coaches. I had to return the money, but it was quite heartwarming when they did it. It was one of the greatest experiences I've done, and I mean that, including the military.
Well, I can't imagine a more perfect way to end that, end our show than what you just said. I think that's so important. When my mentor left the DNC when I worked there, he left a thing on my desk that said, never forget that the cream always rises to the top, but so does the scum. And I've learned that to be true in politics. And you, sir, are the cream. Thank you so much for your service to America. Thank you for still being out there doing the great work that you do in bringing people together. And more than anything, thank you for honoring us by being on our show again today.
Senator, I thank you for that. And thanks for what you're doing trying to get the vote there in D.C. And Maria, I'm blessed that you cared enough to ask about my daughter. Thank you.
I could barely keep it together the rest of this program. I'm so very sorry. But I also wanted to thank you. That story that you told about the robots and the girls, I learned about that. I'm involved with a international organization about abolishing female genital mutilation. And they come from a country that it's very prevalent. So I read about the empowerment that they felt when they got to do what they did, because they've been harmed a lot in their lives due to that cutting. And it was so remarkable to see them rise to the occasion and to be victors.
That's wonderful. And one last thing, if you don't mind. We had 60% of our teams headed by or founded by a woman. And Africa,
wow.
The women, they have STEM girls and STEM bees. And my wife was meeting people to introduce me to them. And I finally, I finally asked one, I hope this doesn't come across wrong, why are women in Africa really the ones that are making this happen? And this one woman said, because we're the ones who really had the family.
Yeah.
And we're going to make it happen for our children. I mean, it was an astounding thing. And when those Afghanistan all-girls team led up, waving their flag, because we had a flag in the Constitution Hall, everybody carried their flags. Man, I told my staff that would be the proudest moment that I could possibly have of this entire event is when they lead the parade of all 158 nations into the Constitutional Hall arena. Thank you both. Be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everything.
We hope to talk to you again soon. We usually leave you with a song in honor of our guest, and I thought we would lighten it up a little today because there's so much going on in the world. So here's the Village People within the Navy for Admiral Sestak.
Nice. And we want to thank our listeners, as always, for making us a priority. Appreciate it. Have a good week, everyone.
Give the people their right to vote.